Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 13th of September. Monday the 14th is the Feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross. We see crosses everywhere. We see them huge and elaborately gilded and decorated. We see simple ones carved or scratched into wood or stone. We wear them round our necks. Sometimes we wear the kind with a little man on them and call them crucifixes. There is only one trouble with all this. Because we see crosses everywhere, we don't see them. I was travelling once with a friend and his son, and the son was at that age when a boy is good for nothing at all except annoying his father. So while we were dutifully admiring a large Baroque crucifix hanging in a German church, he said, "I don't know why you are looking at it. I don't want to look at a sculpture of a man being tortured." Let's ignore the irritatingness, because he must have grown out of it a long time ago by now. If you neglect the malicious intent, he did have a sort of point. We have been saved by Jesus' being crucified, by his submitting to that outrageous event and being absolutely one of us by not summoning legions of angels to rescue him. We have crosses because, despite the horror of the event, we received our salvation through it. We accept the gift, and you might say that we glory in the paradox. The trouble is that we also get used to it. We remember the salvation, and we forget the reality of how it was done. It's well known that if you move into a new house and one of the carpets is torn and needs mending, if you wait even a month before doing it, the tear will be invisible. It will have become part of your visual landscape, and you will simply not see it any more. So it is with crosses and crucifixes. We get too used to them. They become an item of heraldry, almost. We forget what they are representation of. The cross needs to be re-contemplated to keep us from not seeing it any more. Very few people alive today have seen a crucifixion, so this exercise of contemplation has to be a work of the imagination. The Feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross is a good time to attempt it. The feast is also a good time to defend the true cross itself, the actual physical piece of wood, against those who want to expunge it from Christianity. Nothing official has been said, as far as I know, but fashion is at least as powerful as words. A wave of change has engulfed the church. I remember when the faithful at the Easter retreat at Downside would line up on Good Friday to venerate a relic of the true cross. The last few times I was there, they weren't doing it any more. There are two motives for suppressing the true cross. The first is a desire to make Christianity a purely spiritual religion. The last thing any religion like that wants is actual history. It is far more uplifting to treat the crucifixion as part of a possibly invented story of God's love than as a brutal fact. The second motive for suppressing the cross is cowardice. Putting any kind of trust in history is a risk because history gets rewritten. To put one's trust in a physical object is to expose oneself to derision, perhaps even disproof. What if it's a fake? So people say, let's not take that risk. Blessed are those who do not believe because they cannot be disappointed. Let's deal with the cowardice first, because being laughed at is the best way of stopping us from believing. Derisive comedians tell us that there are enough fragments of the true cross around to build a battleship, and we don't dare contradict them because that would show we don't have a sense of humour. It turns out that a French scientist in the 19th century did go round, humourlessly, measuring every fragment of the true cross there was, and he added up their volume. It comes to 4 million cubic millimetres. Millions sounds like enough for a whole fleet of battleships, but it isn't. If you get out your calculator, 4 million cubic millimetres is about the same size as a cube of wood 6 inches by 6 inches by 6 inches. That deals with the numerical argument. As for history, it is clear that these slices, slivers, splinters of wood have been valued above everything else continuously since the 4th century AD. So if you insist on their being fakes, they are going to have to be very old fakes. Must they be fakes? The story is that they were found by Helena, the mother of the Emperor Constantine, who made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. Helena herself has become as encrusted with legends as an icon is with jewels, but that is no reason for the story not to be true. Christianity, after 300 years of having to hide, was out in the open and certain to stay there. The families who had been keeping the precious fragment secret through the generations could now at last admit to its existence. And 300 years is a very short time. Indeed, Hilaire Belloc, writing about the cross, pointed out that the desk he was writing on was older than the cross was when Helena found it. So there is no impossibility in any of this. As for the people who want to make Christianity all spiritual and content-free and above material things, even crosses, let me quote from Evelyn Waugh's novel Helena. Waugh was a master craftsman in English prose. Many of the novels he wrote were sharp, cynical and satirical. Helena feels like his attempt to make amends, to put his great talents to use on a project sincerely intended for good. Here is a speech by Helena in the novel. Of course it is fiction, but like all good fiction, it tells a truth. Helena is talking to Pope Sylvester about the physical evidence for Christianity at a time when Christianity had only just been legalized and purely spiritual interpretations of it were springing up everywhere. How do you know God doesn't want us to have it? The cross, I mean. I bet he's just waiting for one of us to go and find it, just at this moment when it's most needed. Just at this moment when everyone is forgetting it and chattering about the hypostatic union, there's a solid chunk of wood waiting for them to have their silly heads knocked against it. I'm going off to find it, said Helena. In our journey through the Divine Comedy, I've only just spotted an interesting thing. I ought to have noticed it earlier. Dante isn't going through the 7 deadly sins in the order they usually appear in the theology books and missals and things like that. In the books, avarice usually comes as the 2nd of the deadly sins immediately after pride, but Dante puts it much later on. Given that, in the story, he and Virgil are climbing Mount Purgatory, this means that he is putting avarice on a much higher level than usual. I don't know why the books are doing what they are doing, but Dante is right. For one thing, he is putting the sins in exactly the order that St. Gregory the Great used when he first wrote them down in his commentary on the Book of Job. For another thing, that is the right order. Dante sees that everything in the end comes down to a matter of love, and it really does. As Virgil explained to Dante when the knight came and stopped them from climbing the mountain, pride, envy, and anger are the lowest of the sins because sooner or later they all lead us to loving not good, but harm, harm to other people, to pushing them away or pushing them down or just hurting them. Above those three comes sloth, which leads to us doing no harm at all, but no good either. Now we've risen above sloth, and the final three deadly sins all arise from the love of good. Because avarice loves wealth, and wealth is a good thing. Gluttony loves food and drink are a good thing. Lust is to do with other people, and other people are a good thing. The trouble with these three sins is not that they love what is bad. They love what is good, but they love it wrongly. And all the harm in those sins comes from that. How can it be bad to love good things? It comes down to our relationship to them. One way of putting it is this. When you receive something that is good, you have received a gift, and delight comes along with the gift. When you set out to take something that is good, take it for yourself. The best you can hope for is the pleasure of success, not pure delight any more. And when your desire to take that thing obliterates every other desire and good principle you have, nothing but harm could come out of it. I haven't mentioned dogs in this podcast for a couple of months, so here's a dog story as an illustration. Watch a dog come into a new place for the first time. Let's say it's a shop where the people like dogs. It comes in, and don't they make a fuss of it. "Oh, look, aren't you sweet," they say, and they pat it and stroke it and scratch it behind the ears, and in that awkward place by the base of the tail that the dog can never quite get to by itself, and the dog is so happy to be the centre of attention. Happy, happy, happy. And best of all, someone reaches behind the counter and gives the dog a treat. Now watch it next time. The dog comes into the shop just as before, and just as before they try to make a fuss of it, and they pat it and scratch it and say silly things. But the dog isn't happy, happy, happy. The dog says, "Never mind all that. Where's my treat?" It's the same with children. Give a child a present, and the child is purely and simply delighted. Next time, whether it's next birthday or next Christmas or the next time you come and visit, next time the child will expect. And if it gets what it expects, the pleasure won't be quite that simple delight anymore. It will contain a bit of a feeling of crossing off an item from a list of expectations. And this is the way things go for all of us as adults as well, where good things are concerned, good things of almost any kind. We start with appreciation and delight. Next come expectation and desire. At least desire is still desire for a good thing, but wait and see what happens next. The desire becomes a cause of action, a motive of what you choose to do. And in the end, it can grow even beyond that and become the one and only reason you have for doing anything. It defines your life, which is to say, it twists your life out of shape. Where this week's terrace is concerned, the name avarice sounds like desperately holding on to what you've got, while the alternative, covetousness, sounds more like desperately wanting to get more to add to what you've got already. But they are both shoots that grow out of the same basic root, a disordered love of money. Money itself is good, so it's all right to love it. How is it good? Because of where it comes from and what it is for. Money comes fundamentally from good work done well. You mow my lawn, and now my lawn is mown, and I need to do something for you in return for what you did for me. I could find something that I could do for you to pay you back, but it is far simpler and more practical to deal with the matter in money terms. I give you money, and then I don't owe you anything, so I don't need to worry about what I should do for you or what you will ask me to do. In that sense, the payment of money makes us both free. And equally from your end it works. Money will buy you clothes, money will buy you food, money will buy you somewhere to live. It will do all these things, and you can choose which. And you don't need to worry about whether other people will feel like being kind to you in the future, kind enough to give food, clothing, shelter, and all the rest. These are the ways in which, in earning and spending, money is good. Indeed, look at Jesus. Before he embarked on his ministry, Jesus did good work well and was paid for it. One could add one more to the good things about money. Money is honest. If I record a song, let's say, and it's terrible, you can bet a lot of my friends will still tell me how wonderful it is. But money has to be honest, because someone who pays money for what I have made is choosing, just a little, to deprive himself of something else so that he can pay for my work. "Darling, you are wonderful," is cheap and meaningless. "Here's the cash," actually means something because it costs something. If you look at it, all these good things about money involve some other good. Money comes from good work well done, which is a good thing. Money goes on food, clothing, shelter, and so on. Those are good things. Now you have seen the goodness in money, you can begin to see where badness can come from. You can see what the daughters, sisters, and cousins of avarice look like. For instance, I know the value of your work for me, but I underpay you. That is one of the sins that cry to heaven for vengeance. An example from the other side. You know I desperately need your help, so you overcharge me. That belongs to the covetousness side of avarice, and it is deadly not only because it is a sin in itself, but because it will quickly grow on you and become a habit. Once you start charging what you can get away with instead of what you have done is worth, it is hard ever to stop. It will stop being something you have done. It will start being what you are. Now perhaps, when you think about money, you think not about money that flows, but about frozen money, stored money, dead money, about capital. It's the same story, really. Capital is good in that it keeps you safe for the future. If one day you can't work any more, you know that you and your family won't starve. So accumulating capital is an act of prudence. It is good. But dangerously it acquires its own logic because there is no limit to it. When is enough enough? Covetousness answers, never. Concentrated capital is a good thing because you can do big good things with it. I remember St. Elizabeth of Hungary, who out of her riches built two hospitals and a monastery and gave daily support to almost 1,000 poor people. But if you make the concentration of capital the axis and focus of your entire life, it will let you do that. It will twist you round itself until you have love for no one, charity for no one, and you are the servant of something that was meant to exist to serve you. Interestingly, Dante doesn't talk about money at all on the Terrace of Avarice. Instead, he talks about power. Because like money, power can be accumulated, is good when it is used for good, and is deadly when it becomes an end in itself. The first of the shades that Dante meets on the Terrace of Avarice is Pope Adrian V. He was one of those people who, seemingly without trying, find themselves in the right place at the right time over and over again, knowing the right people, so that they themselves rise and rise. Sometimes this kind of accumulation is called social capital. Like any other kind of capital, good can be done with it. Like any other kind of capital, if you devote yourself to getting it, it can be deadly. In Adrian's case, it's possible that being the nephew of a pope helped. After a brilliant church career and some notable achievements of diplomacy, Adrian was elected pope in July 1276, but died a month later. In the Divine Comedy, he repents his climbing and describes his ultimate achievement, the papacy, as a burden he was not equal to. Perhaps the burden really did kill him, history doesn't say. In purgatory, Adrian lies bound face down, just as in life he never looked up to heaven, but spent his time hunched over his plans and schemes. We have a bonus anniversary this week, not the anniversary of a saint at all. Dante Alighieri died 705 years ago on Monday. His vision has given delight and instruction to many. May he be experiencing its fulfilment now. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.